All They Had to Lend, written by Google Essent and read by Chestnut Valley. A Silmarillion story, rated for general audiences. Creator chose not to use archive warnings, and I, the podficker, would say that no archive warnings apply. From a few hundred feet up, the swan ships could be seen to hesitate. They darted ahead, lagged and fanned out, taking separate paths to harvest Manwë's wind. If the wind changed, then they wheeled together, without a breath in which for word to fly from ship to ship. The coordination was too smooth to be amazed by, but Elwing thought that Círdan's fleet had never looked so to the gulls. Nor had it gleamed like frost in the field, small mariners rolling as black motes from bow to stern. How to credit motes with the driving forth of ships? Though in the harbor they had been her own height, cheerful and brave, they clotted the rigging. They argued very cryptically, like an inventor with himself. But everywhere the world had a second face. Rising, she had not seen it turn over, but this must be its underside. Sailors were ash, the bay was wrinkled rock, and foam sprouted to mark where ships had wetted the dry sea. Círdan's fleet, too, had never been escorted by translucent giants. But Elwing paid no attention to the march of the Valar, in case one looked back. Before the fleet set sail, at the farewell feast, Olwë the king had given her a round black crystal, rather ugly. "It will get you news of the war. Sight or sound of the outer lands is not forbidden you." He said it with such certainty, she thought he had not asked to learn if it were true. This speaks to other Palantirs. Finarfin, my son, will gladly share his tidings. Later in the course of the meal, and without acknowledging a lull in their conversation, Olwë said, "When speaking to him, you may find that the image is strange, the color good, but the image warped. The Palantirs took time to perfect. Finarfin's stone, Feanor made him a present of it when Finarfin was young." She tried not to show discomfort or much pity when Olwë spoke of Feanor and his sons. The sting was not in the names. She'd grown accustomed to having her father's murderers for kin, people who might yet die, who might be reasoned with and escaped, never forgiven. It was in his manner, thoughtless, dry, moderated by care for her, but small care for himself, and yet not numb, as though 500 years of the sun had served just to hem in the pain with calm, and as though pain had neither destroyed nor restored the old, impatient, worn-out love, as though time could add and add without receiving back its treasures, and in that way run faster, having unburdened itself. The feast had lasted the night, and at dawn, after Iarendil's departure, she lay awake. If she thought for a moment of Sirion, the pain stabbed deep into her belly. She would then spend hours, or the day, surrendering. But that, at least, was all. To her, no stranger would come, saying, "Here is my pain, which gives me a claim on you." Unless her sons returned. At that she laughed and fell asleep. Unless my son. Now she resolved to fly lower. She spread her wings very far, shoulder bones almost knocking, the wind bailed under her arms. The skin there felt a cool touch worst, spring like winter, winter like the sea. She didn't have the courage to dive when she spied her tower. She came down flapping, doubled up, and touched one foot to sand and knelt, wings thrown over herself like a cloak. The grass-furred dunes were safe enough to walk on, winged. She staggered a little under added weight. Her long gray primaries traced furrows in the sand, but she could think. She did not want to fly further, only because blood had made her head and legs so heavy. The useless stammer of her pulse was like when birds had come to her on these sacred shores, speaking with the old urgency, shouting as they had shouted when she fell. So she had learned their tongue a second time. "And if I forget," she said to herself, grimly, "I will learn again." Always people had built her a tower of unfaced marble. The door had 5 bolts, because she had asked for a bolt. She had to have hands to work the door. Up to her chamber. "Vingilot," she cried, nearly aloud on the stair. "Vingilot. I will wait till he appears." Then, when she had reached the top, she thought she could not bear to wait so long. The deep blue in her window, and the white sun her only visitor. Well, and she had forgotten to set out bread. She did that. Then she spoke to gulls for an hour about the Valar's preparations, the departing hosts, and especially their friends the Teleri, who had so unexpectedly and so graciously consented to captain the ships that would carry those fools, the Spear Elves and the Noldor, some of whom had even been present for, or else had narrowly avoided fighting at, the Battle of Al-Gualonde. "It is strange," agreed Aelwing, tearing out and eating a chunk of coarse bread herself. The rooms in the tower were made for sunset, or the light of the Silmaril, that on every white surface laid the boughs of the 2 trees. Also they were made for music, and gulls' talk fought the vaulted roof in a flat cacophony. Yet she loved the tower at other times. Cold at noon, the black shadows were a balm to her, as much as were the wide sky or the shore. She was safe and safe. Sometimes she woke without sleeping, and sweat taped her dress to her back. A bandage that wanted changing. Mortal wounds she could not find. On this afternoon she did not dream, but, banishing the gulls, sat on the floor to resume work on a pennant for Vingilot, since the army had carried off their banners. The balandir she took from its pedestal, and set down at the end of the pennant to anchor her work. Then somehow, though she checked the sky often, dusk was underway. The design bloomed, unfinished. Aelwing left her needle in the silk. Vingilot's oars worked stiffly in air. Vingilot's sails were not savaged by the winds that worked on Aelwing. Vingilot seemed rather to feel that changeless wind which fills the moon's trim crescent. By a miscalculation, she shot past the railing and had to alight from above on the bow. "I don't remember commissioning a figurehead," said her husband. He planted a hand on her foot, but made no other move to steady her. "Who carved you?"
I was a birch tree in Doriath's woods, and I have fallen greatly in station," she said, trying not to laugh.
Her wings beat time to the hiccups she suppressed. Her husband frowned. His hand crept to her ankle.
"You'll have redress. This is the West.
Yet whoever he was, he must have been a fair craftsman, and so your legs."
"Ah!"
He fell away from the kick, coughing his laughter. Incensed, she hopped down to give chase. They were busy while the ship, of her own genius, laid anchor like Arian in the sea. Busy when fishermen came to fling sweet wreaths and shout, because without Iarendil to pilot it, the ship had made port near a Teleri settlement, north of her tower. At last, a pounding on the cabin door roused Iarendil, who woke her carefully, with a touch on the wrist, as though it mattered now if they made noise. In their hurry, she ended up in his tunic, while he went shirtless to the door. She had time to lace her sandals. Iarendil adjusted the Nauglamir from where it had slipped over one eye, and slid back the latch. The fishermen carried her out, and carried Iarendil out on their shoulders. They tossed him after her into the stinking dinghy, then jumped down themselves with very little discussion. It was night. Faster than night had ever come in Sirion. The Silmaril paved the water with silver and gold. Then, on the pier, they must all drink to the departed fleet, and weep for those who had come home from the halls, and not the sea. someone lent Iarendil their black cloak, saying wisely that he must be chilled. Aelwing ripped the meat from sweet shrimp cooked on the coals, and piled up shells in a gauzy heap, and drank sparingly. The headache from the feast was not quite cured, and it came and went with bright evenness, like it took what it was owed, just half the time. Iarendil, noticing her silence, offered her the Nauglamir. After a minimum of protest, she let him transfer it to her neck. Its weight sharpened the pain to a cruel point, then plucked it out, leaving a fuzzier, enduring warmth. The Silmaril plastered the pier with fine snow. In the alcove of its light, smoke from the brazier hung as rags, and the coals glowed almost pink. "I have a brother," said the man opposite Aelwing, "who has a wife. She goes to fight. He promised me that he would not leave the ship. Do I believe him?" "No," said Iarendil, sounding apologetic. He had an arm over Aelwing's shoulder. "Your brother will wait till the horn is sounded and leap over the side. He'll run through the foam and say to his lady, 'I fell overboard.'" "Do you get along with his wife?" Aelwing asked. She was drowsy and leaden, plagued by untouchable hunger. The absence of pain clasped her throat, scratching her with gold links. She wasn't drunk, but she had Iarendil by her and the Silmaril on her breast. When the fishermen had had enough of their own clear liquor to make requests, she sang a canto of the lay, Lúthien, before Morgoth. In eagerness, she misplaced a verse, and told how Fingolfin rode over Dor Núfáglith in overmastering wrath and hate, but no, it was her grandmother, Lúthien, who wore the demon's skin and flew. She could salvage that. She went from Fingolfin's challenge to Lúthien's lie, binding together two broken couplets. At midnight, the fishers went away singing and rowing away to the cluster of huts on the headland. Aelwing heard the enchantments of Lúthien fitted, first with caution, and then with increasing creativity, to a drinking song, though the words were archaic to her ear. A tumbled version of Iarendil's mother tongue. She was listening with interest, and then she had jumped to her feet. Why did she have to go? She ran up the length of the pier to the beach, heard her footsteps, and ran faster. She would have taken flight if it had occurred to her, but the stars were out, and Iarendil ran behind her, so she had no wings. Her hair swung over her face. Ticklish, dyed muddy red by the jewel. Suppose she lay hidden in a deep brake of reeds while hunters made old music. She fumbled at the Nauglamir's chain. Iarendil came and stopped her and helped her. Throughout, she could not tell him why she had to have it off. She could not be found, could not be caught with the light. She was its protector. Iarendil kept one hand on the side of her neck while she spoke. He gathered the Nauglamir idly in the other, like a torn scrap of mail. "We should go back to the tower," she said, losing the thread of her long explanation. "Olwe gave me a stone. You should see it. We can speak with the host. Not Finarfin right now, perhaps, but someone must stand watch." He said, "Would you like to fight?" She tried to understand. Her panic had almost subsided, though it rose and fell with the hissing from the waves. Iarendil seemed sorry not to have made himself comprehensible. He took the corner of his mantle and draped it over the Silmaril, and the Silmaril, obedient, drew half its light out of the air. What was left had a shape. It flamed in pieces on her face. It made a prism of her lashes, radiant and alive. Iarendil put his other arm around her shoulders. He pressed his cheek to her cheek and rubbed between her shoulder blades, away from where her wings would sprout. His fist with the stone he laid over her heart, as a friend seeking entry. Finally, he pulled away.
He smiled at her in a way that meant he had resolved his trouble, and yet doubted himself. But he looked at her longer, and the smile disappeared. It became just the forgetful pleasure in a smile, pleasure graven deeply on flat calm. He said, "What I do, you do. So do you want to fight?" It was as though they had a secret language which she had neglected to learn. It was like nothing he had ever said to her. Not when he left or returned from his voyages, and not when he asked her to stay aboard the ship lest she be killed. Then she remembered. It was used by the twins. When they were separated by sickness or a parent's unreasonable whim, "What I do, you do." She and Iarendil were not clear of the tide. A wave crashed down, spray raining onto their heads. She could not think how to tell him he was ridiculous. "Yes, of course we will fight." She saw for the first time that in the future their lives would be better. She would have peace, or have it longer, and he would be less patiently afraid. She covered his hand with hers and tugged aside the mantle. The darkness, with the roar of the sea all around them. The Silmaril whitened her chest from inside a ring of red. Red for a warning. She liked that the Silmaril still flashed its warnings. Any word to steer by in this unending storm. This has been All They Had to Lend, written by Gogolescent and read by Chestnut Philly. If you'd like to leave a comment for the author, please visit archiveofourown.org/works/92962258. If you'd like to leave a comment for the Podficker, and please do, they're much appreciated, you can find me at the Archive of Our Own as Chestnut_Philly. Thank you very much for listening.